This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
For those of you who don't know me, my name's Matt Trinker. I'm the director of the National Museum of Australia. And I'd like to start tonight, as always, for events here at the museum, by acknowledging that we meet on the lands of the Ngunnawal, Ngunnawal, Ngambri peoples, who are the traditional custodians of this land. I'm always grateful for the welcome and the generosity of spirit that they show to us here at the museum and the museum community to be on their lands. And I offer my respect to elders past, present and those of tomorrow. And I also want, especially today, as is something that we pride ourselves on here, I want to extend that sense of respect and openness of this institution to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who are with us today. Is that working okay, that mic for you? Is it all good? Great. Tonight, it's written down here, tonight we welcome a dynamic group of panellists to explore the epic issues embodied in our current breakthrough exhibition, Songlines, Tracking the Seven Sisters. It's all true, but we actually have some of my favourite people in the world who are here tonight. They are all great advocates, not just for this show, but indeed for the work that happens in cultural institutions like this, representing the stories, the experiences, the lives of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in this country, and I do thank them for joining us. And, of course, our great host, our great friend of the museum, Paul Barclay, who's here, I think, in your last... Is it your last gig in 2017?
It's the second last of the year. Second last of the year for me.
For you.
The last with the museum.
Yeah, and the sadness about this is that we hear that Paul is actually taking some time off next year. I think it's unaccountable. Why? How can people do that? But he is doing. I just want to say, before we start, a couple of words about Songlines. You know, over the years, we've done work of which I think all of us here at the museum are incredibly proud in bringing both the stories of Indigenous Australia together with the stories of the making of modern Australia. Great traditions, great lines of human experience in this country that we think we have a responsibility to bring together to a point of dialogue, a point of conversation and intersection productively for us in the way that we move forward. But I can honestly say in Songlines that I think we've reached another level in our way of both working with communities and also bringing those stories to public notice. This project was initiated in 2010 by Anangu elders from the APY lands in Central Australia, and it's been led all the way along by senior custodians of the Seven Sisters' stories across the central and western deserts. And there were two animating reasons for people in the communities to work so actively with us. One was that they wanted these stories recorded in ways that might be preserved for future generations. And indeed, one of the proudest things about this work is that all the material that's been gathered through the course of the production of the exhibitions is being vested in Ara Irigidja, the Indigenous-run archive in Central Australia. And secondly, there's a great openness and willingness of the people right across those lands, across the three great lands, Mardu Country, APY and Nanajara lands, to open up this story for all Australians to share in. That's a great gift, in my opinion, and one that I take a great sense of responsibility to honour and do the very best we can with. I think the resulting exhibition that features 100 paintings and photographs, installations, and, as Paul said, better than me, in fact, these very dynamic media experiences. And you'll hear from Curtis, who's been very involved in the production of those and who has a great career of doing this work in this museum and others. I can't wait to hear the reflections of our panellists tonight on this project. I do think these stories are absolutely elemental to our national story in this country. We should be so delighted that we live in a country that has such a long human history of storytelling, story making of culture, which is what storytelling is really, in place. And it's a great honour to be in working in this museum at a time when we bring this work to the public. Welcome to Alison Page, Scott Rankin, Curtis Taylor and Margot Neal, and as I said, a great welcome to our host Paul Barclay of ABC RN's Big Ideas. Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. Welcome to the National Museum of Australia. It is a delight to be back here as usual. It's been a terrific year of cooperation with the museum and some fabulous programming that's come from it as well. Some terrific conversations, and we're about to have another one of them. I host Big Ideas on Radio National. It's on air Monday to Thursday nights at 8 p.m. and you can download it via podcast. We have a very big podcast following. If you don't subscribe to us, give us a go, download it. You'll find plenty of interesting stuff on there. In 1992, I took a train from Melbourne that would eventually take me to my new home in Alice Springs, where I got my first job working for the ABC. It's a long train ride, that one. You get the train to Melbourne and then you get the train from Adelaide to Alice, the GAN. You have plenty of time to read and contemplate. When you stare out the window, you watch the soil gradually change colour and you begin to appreciate the vastness of this amazing continent and the long history as well. I've done that trip many times, but I look back on that first journey and cringe. Here I was, this white fella from the city, armed conspicuously with a copy of Bruce Chatwin's Songlines to culturally prepare me for what lay ahead. Here is the book, by the way, the book I took with me that's a little bit the worse for wear. What a bloody cliche I was, a white fella reading a book by another white fella about an integral yet almost unknowable part of Aboriginal culture. The dreaming, the foundational stories and lore of our first peoples. So how are we to understand the Songlines? Is it too elusive a concept for us, especially for us white fellas, to understand? Well, the National Museum of Australia's Songlines exhibition tracks the Seven Sisters' Songlines. This is an incredibly ambitious project initiated by the Ananu elders from the APY lands, the Ananu, Pitjantjatjara and Yankunytjatjara lands in central Australia, and led by the senior Seven Sisters custodians from across the central and western deserts. To talk about the Songlines project and Songlines as storytelling, we've got a great panel of guests tonight. As I said, if you want to tweet throughout this conversation, please feel free. Let me introduce the panel to you. On my immediate left, I have Alison Page, an Indigenous scholar and designer, a descendant of the Walbunga and Wadi Wadi people of the Yuin Nation, and an award-winning creative at the forefront of the contemporary Australian Aboriginal cultural movement. Next to Alison, we have Scott Rankin, a writer and director who for 25 years has been the creative director of arts for social change organisation Big Heart. This year, Big Heart celebrates with the Namajira family the return of Albert Namajira's copyright to his family after an 8-year campaign fighting for justice. Well done, Scott. A lot more to that story, another story indeed, but still a terrific outcome. Next to Scott, Adjunct Professor Margot Neal, the Senior Indigenous Curator and Advisor to the Director of the National Museum. And next to Margot, Curtis Taylor, filmmaker, screen artist, young Matu leader. He's an active member of the Western Desert Lands Aboriginal Council. Curtis was part of the crew and cultural liaison in the virtual reality artwork Collisions. I can tell you, calling it a virtual reality artwork doesn't go anywhere near describing how incredible this is. It won an Emmy Award this year, and it is truly incredible. Well done, Curtis. Fantastic work to you and the team. Now showing here at the museum. Let's kick off the conversation. I'll come to you first of all, Margot, with the hardest question, first of all. What are the Songlines? I mean, In one very simple sense, they are the shortest distance between two water holes, but there is so much more to it than that. In as concise a language as you can you explain the song lines to us? That is your challenge.
First of all, they're inexplicable. And secondly, for the purposes of obviously doing a project like this and communicating something to people, you can't say, sorry, it's called Songlines, but I don't know what it is. So really, at a sort of fundamental level, they're like pathways or corridors of knowledge. You can visualise it as pathways or corridors of knowledge that crisscross the continent, lay down over millennia, and at another level, they are the knowledge system which governs all aspects of Aboriginal life and society. And if you've heard the expression, our stories or history is written in the land, then that's a kind of embodiment of the sense of how it works by reading the land.
Hey, Curtis, how do you understand the song lines as a young fella? What, if I was to ask you what the song lines meant to you, what would you say?
For me, it's a history of the land where I come from, my local area, but also this universal view of country and connection between animals, art, people, the whole kind of cosmos of, you know, what it makes up. And there's song lines that are shared between local groups, between certain individuals, or between a vast area of people. But also, they can be composed from certain individuals any time and can make up the culture of that time.
Mm. Alison?
Can I just jump in?
Yeah, sure. Just jump in. Just quickly, Margot.
Yeah, just the for those to understand, it's there is some kind of resonance with the word dreaming or dreaming tracks or jukupa. So when you ask some of the people we work with what song lines, they say, it's jukupa, it's the law.
Mm. Do you understand the song lines, Alison?
Look, it makes my head hurt. But the reason why it makes my head hurt, and even though I'm an Indigenous woman, I was educated in a Western system, and I think really I need to go through a process now of pretty much unlearning everything that I've learnt and just re-educating myself in that way, because I think in a Western in Western education, you know, and in Western science and in Western knowledge systems, which are also living systems, by the way, the categorisation of knowledge is what we're sort of all obsessed with, you know. Taxonomic classification of knowledge into, even with science, you know, there's 100 different disciplines. Whereas with song lines, and the reason why I find it, you know, I was reading the articles that are in the beautiful book that was produced, and my head actually did hurt, because the arts, philosophy, science, all of the sciences all exist, the past, the present, the future all exist within song lines. And so I think that's why it's called a maelstrom of knowledge that, you know, is hard for people to get their head around, because we have this propensity to want to kind of break it down into linear forms. And even with Bruce Chatwin, you know, talking about it as a navigation system, you know, that was read by people as like a map, you know, to get from A to B, you know, you sing the song. And it's much more complicated than that.
Although he did talk about how his understanding of the culture was that the land was sung into being, and as it was sung, it was created. And that starts to get close. You know, Scott, I've done a bit of a 360 in my thinking about this as a result of going along to the exhibition today. You know, I'd always wondered whether or not it was sacred knowledge, in a sense, that song lines had this deep and profound meaning to Indigenous people that us white fellas could never understand, and that it was perhaps even immaterial whether we could. And now I understand that it's fundamentally important for us white fellas to understand it, because we occupy this continent together. These are the foundational stories of the continent, and we should share in these amazing stories. Do you agree that we And can we as white fellas understand the song lines and what they mean?
It's a good question. I'd say two things. One, it is the physical and communicable face of the unknown in one sense, and it's also like stand-up comedy in another when you go to that exhibition, because the quality of storytelling comes from, you know, 2,000 generations compared to 10 generations in contemporary Australia and, you know, 38 generations since Shakespeare. So this is shit-hot storytelling, and beneath it is are the unknowable, the private knowledge, which I think in another, you know, 500 to 1,000 generations, this continent will be sharing, you know, very deeply with everyone who lives here.
Mm. And we will come to the actual stories of the Seven Sisters in a moment. But before we do, I'm curious, Curtis, why Matu Elders supported the Seven Sisters Songlines project, why it was felt that this was an important project to support to get the songlines out to the general public.
I think for this certain songline that the ladies 30 odd years ago, they had a convention, I think, at Kunoriti, World 33, and a lot of different indigenous mob came from all over the tri-state border and far as the West Pilbara, where it started, and they wanted to invite Ngalama and Indibani ladies to kind of lead the way. And in the case of Maru, they saw that it's really important to share and preserve and record this knowledge for future generations, but also generations that have maybe not learned or picked up that knowledge and truly understand. So a lot of Maru were really, really strong in bringing this songline to the forefront. Like one man we call it Mira. Mira, he's like revealing what's hidden in my dialect. And a lot of Maru people saw that, you know, it's need to be shared and need to be revitalised again, you know, between different people, so that it lives on through memories of people that remember it and still have that visual knowledge of that, but also new generations that are learning and wanting to learn and are hungry for it.
Well, that's crucial, isn't it? Passing this knowledge on to the younger generation, because you live within an oral storytelling culture. If those stories are not orally passed on to younger generations, those stories die. And if the stories die, a part of your culture dies with those stories.
Yeah, and definitely, like, you know, at the beginning you said, you know, some of these stories can be elusive, and I think in those kind of cases that, you know, these stories can be elusive, where if you don't practice or relearn them, then it's lost forever.
Mm. Yeah. Margot, the song lines were also beginning to fragment, to be broken up, I understand, by past releases, by mining and so on. So is the exhibition in part also a way of keeping them together and promoting them for the future?
Yeah, I'm just going to add to what Curtis said.
Mike, you might.
Oh, sorry. I know I have a loud voice, but... just what Curtis said too, there's this whole other idea that the country dies as well. If the culture dies and not activated, the country dies, as John Bradley so aptly puts in a book he did. And that leads to the preservation, as you intimated earlier. The Anangu, a particular Anangu elder, David Miller in 2007, echoed... And very specifically, you know, saying the song lines have all been broken up and we need you mob to help us put them back together again. The real concern really is this generational transfer, because as we know, the young of this time are very involved with their devices and are not so keen on hanging out in the bush with the elders and thinking about later. So they very proactively and strategically, I have to say, because a lot of these people are first contact people, approaching places like museums and Australian National Universities. No big, it's a big deal, right? We're not renowned for being the best friends historically speaking. So it was a big deal and they were fearful. And the purpose was to use, now we're talking about the archive, is to use that fatal flaw of the Western Archive, which is to freeze time so they could get this material documented, tracked, documented, put into Arariritja, a particular Aboriginal-managed archive, and so that when those young fellas come to their senses, as they believe they would, and the elders are gone, they'd be able to access this material. And, you know, that was a huge thing. This is this sort of, you know, hybrid movement.
But it's also extremely practical in the sense when you look at the demographics of Indigenous people across Australia, you know, half of Aboriginal Australia is 24 years or younger. So this notion, you know, I'd love to have grown up, you know, where I had the opportunity to sit under the tree with Auntie and learn all about my culture. But the truth is Auntie has to sit under the tree with about 40 kids. You know, she's probably a bit traumatised about it, to be honest. You know, and, you know, there's... In near where I live, near Kempsey, you know, there's 30-year-old grandmothers there. So this whole idea of how culture is being sustained in communities, and you would know with Big Heart's work as well, is, you know, it does need revitalising with new medium. And digital medium is incredibly powerful for that. And so even if communities decide to put stories to sleep for a while, until those protocols have been met or the youth have gone through their rights and they deserve the story, well, they can revitalise them through the digital medium.
Yeah, it was striking to me that actually, and we at the ABC are having that conversation at the moment about we need to engage with young people in the form that they consume, you know, present our stories through mobile phone and through modern technology. And in a sense, that's what this exhibition is doing. It's translating that knowledge and presenting it to us in the most modern form.
In a new language.
Yeah, exactly, indeed. Indeed. So, Margot, let's just talk about the Seven Sisters story, Song Lion's story. This is a story about how the land and stars are formed. It's also a story, a saga, really, of an endless journey made by a female ancestral beings who are being pursued by a powerful mythological figure. And it made me think when I was walking through the journey that the exhibition is that, you know, women have been chased by blokes from the very beginning of time.
80,000 years.
Some things never change. Can you just give us a kind of an overview of the Seven Sisters Songline story?
Well, not to be too conformist here and answer directly, I need to just refer to that digital culture, making culture cool for young people, right? Because Curtis has a fabulous quote in there, in case you didn't see it, which says we have, like the old people, we have a dreaming too. Ours is a dreaming with new technology. We will tell the oldest culture with the newest technology. Now, I think it's profound, right? Yeah. From a young fella who's had to talk to the elders to get the story. And so this exhibition has some 20 pieces of multimedia, which the dome is the, you know, crescendo, the state of art. So it's all part of the story. The actual, just to give the big story, is it is an epic saga. And it's ancestral, it's an archetypal narrative that belongs to all major civilizations have it. This one is about a shapeshifter or an ancestral being, if you like, who for the purposes of the story, so people can remember it, takes on human values. And he is in pursuit of the Seven Sisters whom he's looking to possess. In order to lure them to him, he needs to transform himself into a whole range of different disguises, a little bit Shakespearean here, and he turns into delectable food sources, desert water, of course, all the things they need, and shade trees under which the women will shade, and therefore he can lure them towards him. So, but that's only the base level. It's really about the idea of the origin of the land, the explanation of the seasons, how to manage gender relationships appropriately. So it's got that other multiple layers. It's not just that story, but this story...
That was the G-rated version.
Yeah.
Oh. That was the Disney version.
That's the Disney version. And so, mostly, I just want to say in terms of the exhibition, this the details of that template I just described change according to the changes of the land. So from one desert to one rocky country to a sand dune country, it is different because it created the land, a story like this. So the land and the story become one and the same, and the people, and then it's mapped into the people.
And the song lines are obviously a map as well. We're talking about lines that move through three states, three deserts, across 500,000 square kilometres. They're visually represented very well in the exhibition. It's kind of hard to give a sense of it here on the radio. But the song lines essentially stretch across the whole continent, don't they?
Yeah, they, in fact, you know, actually, the Seven Sisters story exists across the entire continent, and clearly we did the Central and Western Desert partially. But as also some of the elders, I think it was Nola Taylor, she says, no, this story belonged to the whole world, Ireland, Japan, the whole world has this story. And, of course, when you think about the Orion and Pleiades, and if there's a scientist in here, I might be, you know, counteracted. But it's my understanding that because the Orion and Pleiades are visible in the northern and southern hemisphere, this story goes everywhere. Subaru. Seven Sisters.
Yeah.
To start with.
Yeah, so the encounters between the Seven Sisters and their ancestral pursuer become features of the land itself, reflected in the night sky as the Orion constellation and the Pleiades star cluster. So you get to see that kind of connection between Earth and the sky through the story. Scott, these are foundational stories. You're a storyteller. It's what you do for a living, really, is tell stories. Why are these stories so important to us?
I would put it like this, and using the words of Professor Said, who said that nations are narrations and they're always in transition. They're always being told, whether it's Curtis in your traditions or in the traditions that have grown out of the West and the Judeo-Christian traditions, it is always telling the story, and the story has to be inclusive. So if you are excluded from the narration, you won't be part of the nation and you will be damaged, or you'll be left aside, or you'll be put on an island in the Pacific, or you will end up seeing your children locked up in Australian prisons right now, where 50% of all the children we lock up, forgive me, Curtis, but are Aboriginal young people. That is that we shouldn't be playing the ashes. We should be telling the story of Australia's injustice and the complexity of that injustice. And so narrations need to be told all the time. And yes, in our education system, we say that STEM is important and, you know, it's got to be science and technology and English and maths, but it's STEAM that is vital, because if you don't have the arts in the education system, you won't have storytellers, and you will end up excluding people, damaging people and hurting people, because it's much harder to hurt someone if you know their story. That's the main reason that the last 10 generations have been vexed and at war, essentially, on this continent with Curtis's people, because it's much easier to hurt someone when you exclude their story.
Mm.
So it is critical.
And if we lose those stories, Indigenous people have lost their land over the years as a result of colonisation. They've lost much more than that as well. If we lose these stories, it's, in a sense, another form of genocide, really, isn't it?
Do you mind if I jump in?
Yes, sure.
I mean, you know, I think what concerns me is that in the luxury of the barista of Lonsdale Street, or the superb cuisine of, you know, Fitzroy or Gertrude Street or wherever in Melbourne, etc., around the country. We tut-tut at the past over our chai lattes and our, you know, beautiful pinots, because we can distance ourselves from the guilt of the moment that we live in now. And the guilt is just one part of the equation, because there's great celebration in living now as well. But, you know, I think for us, we need to take responsibility for the moment that we're in and the storytellers we are. It's not exactly answering your question. And be willing to be absorbed into the country that we live in and allow it to speak to us, which for peak predators like me, tall, white, cis males who are running the globe, it's very hard when you're bred like a stallion. That sounds terrible. When you're bred with this acute acumen for binary thinking.
Yes.
You know, you can't shut up. Now, I noticed, you know, when we were sitting in the room preparing, it was hard for us to shut up, you and I. And it's something that we have to do, because we have to listen, like David Ireland said, to the belly of the country.
Curtis, are you going to any thoughts on that? On us white fellows who won't shut up?
I think, you know, there's in the future it'll be different. And in the Northern Territory and top half of South Australia, I can see already that, you know, my travels there and in the Western deserts of Western Australia, that you have not just Anangu or Maru speaking language and being really deeply connected or invested in the learning of the land and the culture and the language, but there will be different generations coming up that are more... multiracial, but also because of, you know, there will be Indigenous people having relations with, you know, outside of their community. And those generations that come after that will be knowledge keepers and storytellers of their ancestors from their parents, telling those stories again and holding that really tight and not losing it. And I think it'll just be more of a kind of collective Australian psyche will change, that it'll be more grounded to the Kaninjara, you know, to the underground, to where the land is. So, yeah, it's going to be different in the future, where a lot of speakers will maybe not look like me or not look like you, you know? Mm.
Other words, you'll be bred out.
Just as there was a policy of breeding out black.
I think that's a really interesting point,
breeding them but white, it used to be, that's right, expression.
So Curtis and I have worked in Roban, Curtis on a project that we've been running up there. And Iramugadu, or Roban, is the start of the story that you're telling in the museum.
Yeah.
It is also... it's also media poverty porn candy for the contemporary media, using it to insist that we see Aboriginal Australians through a deficit lens rather than the asset at the place that we live, exactly what you're talking about. And Roban, you know, has been 7 years of teaching to me as a community. It's a fantastic place. Our families who live there never lock the doors. The children play happily. In the 60s, when Lang Hancock and that family, Gina's family, saw the potential to become a dynasty of wealth, there were it was a community struggling, and there were about 30 people who would turn up for law business. There's thousands of people who turn up there to Woodbrook each year, right now, and yet we do not tell that story. We insist that it's much easier to have sympathy rather than envy, and we've got to stop.
Mm. Yeah. Roeburn being the place, actually, where the song lines... I think it's where it's agreed that the song lines begin.
No disagreement at all. Rare. Yeah.
But the other thing that strikes me about these stories is their epic quality. Epic in a universal sense. And I don't know whether you've got any thoughts on this, Alison. I was thinking about the... You know, we grow up with the Greek myths and legends, and we grow up with the understanding of Narcissus and Oedipus and what they tell us and help us to understand about the modern world, yet we haven't grown up with the foundational stories of our own land.
Which is an absolute tragedy, because I think if you've got a culture that survived for 80,000 years, that survived the last glacial movement, you know, the last ice age, essentially, you know, Aboriginal people abandoned 80% of the landmass, you know, that's a sophisticated understanding of being able to read the climate for a start, and then being incredibly adaptable to be able to do that in order to survive. But also having only, you know, only working 15 hours a week, you know, and do it using the rest of the time to make art and to connect with one another, you know, and we were called the savages. You know, and here we've got people on the weekends doing their BCF, boating, camping, fishing stuff. You know, and they're doing boating, camping, fishing for 15 hours and then working as slaves in their jobs for 40 hours. You know, Aboriginal people were boating and camping and fishing for 80,000 years and they only had to do it for 15 hours a week and they made art the rest of the time. You know, that's an advanced society. And so I would be looking at the values at the heart of those stories and the heart of the culture, because the stories change. As the culture changes, as the landscape changes, the culture changes and everyone adapts. But the constant over those 80,000 years, you know, and I've had to think about this because I'm from La Perouse, so I'm from ground zero where culture was destroyed. I don't have language. We didn't have our dreaming stories. So I've had to think about making new ones. And if we're going to sit down and compose new stories, like Curtis was saying, like, well, where do you start? You know, and I think those kind of instructional... You know, I think we should have stories about how to teaching young kids, you know, in community, and this could go across all Australia. If, you know, if you grow up in a house with a single mum, maybe you should help out a little bit by doing the dishes. You know, I want to hear that epic story.
I'm sure you do. I'm sure you're not the only one who wants to hear that story too.
Yeah, but they're didactic, they're instructional, and when you don't have a written language, you have to embed that kind of knowledge. And you know, that's why a lot of the stories are about sharing and so on. You know, and if you don't, you're always going to turn to stone. They nearly always end like that.
Yeah. A solidarity story, yeah. We had the solidarity story before the unions.
Scott.
I just wanted to try a quick survey for radio.
Yeah, sure.
Just wondering, who in the audience knows how to say hello in the language of the country where the Eiffel Tower sits as a great tourist icon in the room? The radio, almost all the hands went up.
That's most people. Mm.
Who knows how to say hello in Pitjantjatjara language on the country where the great icon of Uluru stands, right where we live? 2, 3, 4. That's pretty average. Now, it's not pushing that for a guilt reason, it's pushing it for a policy reason. Mm. That if language is disappearing and the capacity to whisper the sounds of language from elder to child or from Aboriginal to non-Aboriginal person, it's because of a policy genocide. We have to claim these things and name them now and ask for change politely in a non-adversarial way. You know, get beside your MP if there's any left in Parliament. Just see how. but to me, that is what you're saying. New story. Here we are in this great opportunity, incredibly intact cultures. incredible cultures that are relearning, where I live on the northwest of Tasmania, incredible issues there. And there is great courage and ongoing strength in the reclaiming of language, the remaking of story. And guess what? We generously, Scott, whose parents are Irish and English, generously invited in, you know, all over the country to come and be part of that as much as part of any other culture in this country.
Indeed. Michael, let's talk about the exhibition itself. I had a walkthrough just a few moments ago. It's important to say from the outset, this is an Indigenous-initiated project. You were approached by Aboriginal people to put this exhibition on quite a long time ago, actually. Tell us how it happened and the genesis of this project.
Well, yes, it started that way, you know, from little things, big things grow, as we know.
As they say.
So it started as the Anangu Initiative, who were concerned for the reasons you've spoken about already, for preservation reasons, and they approached both the museum, the ANU, the moons lined up, if you like. They've been trying for a decade previously, but I can see why people just didn't take it on willy-nilly. It's quite an undertaking. But the moons lined up and the ARC, we got an ARC grant. But what was initiated wasn't an exhibition. In the first instance, it was actually an archival project to track and document the songlines, as I said, for Arariru Titja, and to pass on. And a lot of these people also hadn't been back to country for 50 years. Some had never been to country. They just knew their country through story. A whole heap of stuff was happening on the sidelines. And then part of it was sort of the secondary thing was that there'd be an exhibition. And one might say, why bother? If you get the archive, you get your story, why have an exhibition? Well, this mob are very strategic and they know, apart from that interesting the younger people, if they don't get all of Australia on side, as has been said here, and acknowledge the centrality of songlines to the Australian story. In other words, this mob are saying, if you're Australia and you live in this continent with us, then you need to know your stories. So it's not just being nice and sharing them, it's actually political as well as, you know, a survival, one of the other survival mechanisms, and to demonstrate that these aren't just little myths and legends. These are these huge learning instructional tools and everyone needs to get on board and we'll all learn from it.
See, the way museums usually work is that the museum has an idea and it decides it's going to do something and then it goes and talks to all of the people that are involved in this idea, and if they're an enlightened institution, they'll consult with the people they should consult. This has flipped the model completely around, hasn't it? Where actually someone's come to you and said, this is really bloody important. The whole of Australia should know about it. You guys at the museum, you know how to do this sort of thing. But very much it comes from the community, from the elders, the custodians themselves, right?
Yeah, well, this is an Australian history museum, and if we're doing our job, which may have not missed them either, and we're a new museum, we don't sort of really... in perception, we don't actually come with all the baggage. But museums, as you know, our mob saw them as harbingers of the loot, from the stolen loot and of our ancestors, and there was that kind of bad reputation. So it is particularly poignant, right, number one. Number two, it is redefining the way communities work with museums as opposed to how museums work with communities. So these elders are not our reference group or our advisory council or anything. They are the curators of the country, and this exhibition is curated country. So we were all knowledge holders. There wasn't them and us and they're better than us or we're better. It was knowledge holders, which are shared skills and knowledges to bring together them of the content, if you like, us of the Western sciences and curatorial school in this place, which belongs to all Australians, and that includes Australians who hold and tell story differently.
And this has occurred over an almost 10-year period that we're talking about when you were first approached, and museum staff have gone out onto country. There's vast expanse of country with the elders representing the various parts of the Seven Sisters songlines, working closely with them. I mean, this is an immense undertaking, really, isn't it?
Yeah, this is, you know, I've been in the curatorial business for 30 plus years, but this is not like most of my exhibitions where you go to other collecting institutions, you borrow their stuff, you commission a few works and so on. This is absolutely primary research, you know, and as you say, these are huge trips in the desert, sandhill country, convoys of cars, elderly people, many in not such good health. Time scale's different, and it's, you know, it's like I never want to sleep in a riverbed again. done up, finished up with it. And Sita, who's here, did a few of the big trips, and you know, the last Mardu trip was like 30 people, 8-10 cars, 600 kilometres, no roads.
Mm.
And the people, and what we went to get, we couldn't get very much because not the right people were there to talk for that country or to tell that photo. You can't tell any of this. You can have this huge trip planned and get there and whoops, nice packing and unpacking Toyotas every day for 10 days, but...
Yeah.
So it is very much a... I don't know how to explain. Yes, it's... on-the-ground exhibition development.
Mm, indeed. And just not to mention the fact that the exhibition itself also brings together all of the knowledge and information and insight that you'd expect from a curatorial institution, but it's also an art exhibition as well. The artwork is absolutely astonishing. Now, Curtis, I wanted to talk about another thing that's happening alongside as kind of part of the Seven Sisters Songlines exhibition, and that's Collisions, this incredible, amazing virtual reality artwork that takes us on a journey of the land of Indigenous elder Ngari Ngari Morgan from the Mardu tribe in the remote West Australian desert, your country. You are part of the documentary crew and cultural liaison of Collisions. This year won an Emmy Award for Outstanding New Approaches in Documentary after strapping on... let's give him some applause. After strapping on the VR headset and the headphones, I can see why you won an award. Impossible to describe on radio. A brilliant approach. Can you just tell us about Collisions, what the idea behind it was and why you thought it was important to tell this story, the story of Maralinga, in the way that you did?
Yeah, I think, it's a team effort, and Gary and Lynette Walworth was at the front, and I was kind of... behind my elder, Ngari, and also Lynette, telling this story, translating it across so that... So on the project, I was a director's attachment to Lynette and translating what Lynette wanted to get out of Ngari in the shot on the day when we were shooting, and also translating what Ngari said so that... we made sure that we got what we needed on the day and when we were shooting. So this is just not Ngari's story, but I think it's more of a collective South Australian Arnamu story, and also the service people that worked on the project. So both sides, people who were affected, people who worked on this on the project, on the Australian and British sides. This is a story that we all need
yeah. to know about. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on.
Ngari was at the time in the 1950s with two other people walking through towards the tri-state area, tri-state border. WA, Northern Territory, South Australia, towards Maralinga area. And so that area was a huge trade route for the tri-state peoples, you know, Western Desert peoples. They traversed that country for millennia, trading ochre, ceremony, stories. So they were there in the 1950s and witnessed this thing that they didn't have a name for, was, you know, this mushroom cloud, and this effect is after all the stuff that came after falling from the sky, that they learned the names when they were in the missions in Warburton, that it was an atomic bomb and atomic testing. And, yeah, it was awesome to just be on the journey with Nyeri and Lynette and Nola, touring it too. So we shot it over a week, did it. Post-production was 8 months, and we finished it off just in time to take it to the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, in Davos. Nyeri didn't have a passport out then until, like, 1 week out of the trip that we got it. And so, yeah, we showed it to heads of state from all over the world, and Nyeri got to be there in virtual reality and be there as, you know, in presence of them, talking about and sharing similarities between people from Kazakhstan, from New Mexico, from all over the world that had, similar stories from nuclear, stories.
Can you remember the first time you watched the final product, put the headset on and the headphones on? Because it is an incredible experience, isn't it, seeing the nuclear bomb go off, the white light rushes toward you, the kangaroos burning in front of you. How did you feel when you first saw that yourself?
Well, I was there in the post-production when they did the animation in the US in California, in Berkeley, and we worked with the animation team, Whiskey Tree, in the Bay Area. So I was there advising them on, like, you know, what color the earth is and the kangaroos and the sounds that these kangaroos make and the landscape that it was around then. So I saw it on a flat screen and also in the HTC Vive, which is attached to your desktop, so that, I could experience while we were editing virtual reality. So, I think it didn't hit home with me until I was there with Nyeri 1 week out of when we were traveling to Switzerland, that was in Perth, and was just having breakfast at my house in Leederville. And I said, "Oh, this is the demo. This is the final product. What do you think?" And we put it on together and saw it. And he just, didn't say anything. Just gave the thumbs up. And I was, really happy.
It's quite overwhelming, isn't it, Alison? That piece at the end with Robert Oppenheimer telling the story as the kind of coda to the story.
Look, it's interesting because Lynette and I were in Maralinga in the late 90s together. We were working on the Adelaide Festival. My job was to go and build an art room because the community had never, in Oak Valley, had never painted before, and they wanted to paint about the bomb. And so Lynette had started that sort of, you know, the journey with that story really back then. And interestingly, you know, we were hugely criticised for taking a lot of the Adelaide Festival out to Oak Valley, to somewhere that was completely remote. And, you know, Peter Sellers was sacked as the artistic director, and it was incredibly controversial. And, you know, I just sort of think about, you know, how full circle that's all gone now, and the fact that, you know, because there was a play written, Mamu was written as well by Trevor Jamison, amazing play, paintings, you know, but the story didn't resonate until this work was created. And, you know, VR is incredibly powerful medium in terms of, you know, they call it an empathy machine for a very good reason, because you can actually feel completely part of the story. And, you know, I think it's, you know, a big sign of things to come when we start to see these projects that are advocating for social justice, you know, adopting these kinds of mediums, which I believe are very culturally appropriate. When you look at something like augmented reality, where you rub your, you roll your smartphone over the landscape and the stories come to life, that's a very Indigenous concept, the idea that the land is speaking to you, but it's going to literally speak to you with these new digital mediums.
Yeah, so Scott, there's that. There's the virtual reality collisions that we saw today, but then there's also the Dome Lab within the Seven Sisters Songlines exhibition itself, this huge immersive 6-metre dome that showcases rarely seen rock art where you kind of lie beneath it. Do you think that these contemporary digital ways of storytelling are the way to go in terms of taking those stories to a new generation of people?
I think it's the arrogance of the contemporary that we go, technology's just started in our lifetime, so it's always been technology, and I don't think there is transitioning technology, and there always will be, and it is accelerating. I think there are a couple of issues there. One, and Curtis, you would be better to comment, but there is an incredible array of private knowledge of which you earn the cultural right to be involved in, and then there is what is safe for other Australians to see. And I'm not sure that the digital domain, as we in its amateurish first 2 decades, is necessarily particularly useful for the private knowledge. But I do think it's really useful for building the protections of narrative across the country. So that's a critical thing, and probably I shouldn't go on, so you interrupt me here.
Well, Margot, I mean, why did you choose these more digital methods for telling the story of Seven Sisters? There are, of course, numerous canvas artworks that people would recognise, to use the vernacular, as Indigenous dot paintings as well throughout the exhibition, but the centrepiece is this dome, this immersive dome, and that's a very important part of the journey that you take when you go through this exhibition. At what point did you decide that was going to be the way in which you took people into the Seven Sisters Songline story?
Well, really at that sort of that early stage of forming things, you do it mostly, you know, you just get a sense of stuff, right? So I had a sense, this whole song lines and the way our people pass on stories and knowledge is a very embodied multi-sensory process, right? So as Scott just said, you know, the digital isn't new, really, when you think back. So that's one thing. The second thing is you've got to be immersed and totally absorbing and inhaling it. That's how you learn it, just not text on a wall, though some people need that. The other thing is that, don't forget, the first projections or cinema experiences were really in these rock art caves, right? They are the first dome theatres.
Yep.
The fire, the flickering firelight, the animating of the figures, the whole, that is, in some ways, if you stretch your imagination, you can start seeing the dome in that same way.
Absolutely,
so it's perfectly appropriate. Then there's the whole idea of multimedia, multi-sensory, multiple points of entry, multiple ways of imparting knowledge. And so I think, and then there's the making culture cool for the young fellas. You know, that's all part of that. I think we can't see it yet, but I've no doubt that if we got this dome to Araluen or something, but even here, the bush news is just whipping up big time around the deserts, and one way or another, they'll all want to get on the wagon and learn the story.
Well, let me just say one thing here, and I think, again, it's an issue that's invisible and critical, and it's the issue of digital justice. And if you look at the Australian Digital Inclusion Index right now, if you're Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, if you're a young woman, if you're from a low socioeconomic background, if you're mobile only, you are currently falling rapidly behind the rest of the population and your peers who are engaging in the digital economy. It's exactly the same, and we're doing this, I'm doing this, it's exactly the same as when the blackboard and chalk was invented, you only show it to the rich kids. That's happening to Indigenous Australia right now and people who live across the class divide and live in perpetual generational poverty. And look, it sounds like this is super heavy, but it's, you know, it's radio. It's, we're so close. You're just two calls from the Prime Minister. Ring Lucy. Get on. Have a conversation.
She's here, isn't she?
have a conversation, because it's as critical, I think, as what we're doing currently to Aboriginal people by excluding them from superannuation. And Marcia Langton is one of the only people speaking about that. These are critical issues as we sip our chai lattes that we've got to do something about, because it is story. It's just
the digital
kind of
divide. And this must be an important thing for you to consider, Curtis, because this is the medium that you work in. Young people are digitally connected, but as Scott says, unfortunately, Indigenous people just don't have the access that many of us take for granted in the rest of the country.
Yeah, and for many different reasons, you know. But I just wanted to come back with what you said earlier about the sacredness of the country, and with the, in the case of collisions, when we shot around the country, that we introduced the camera to Nyeri, which was a 16-rig camera in a sphere. So when Nyeri put on the headset and saw the camera, he immediately said, "Oh, well, that camera has 16 eyes, and I know where to place it in my country, and, you know, make sure what the viewers, what the audience is going to see, that I want them to see." And it's clear. It's not sacred, or it's not for certain people's eyes. So, yeah, that was the challenge, and it was also checked by ladies and men when we shot in virtual reality.
Okay, just another thing we haven't touched on, Alison, that the song lines reveal much about traditional Aboriginal understanding of the world, the land, the plants, the sky, and so on. They're a window into a different way of thinking, to us Western white fellas anyway. What do song lines reveal about Indigenous knowledge of this place we live on, the plants, the animals, Indigenous science, in a sense?
Yeah, well, science and technology from an Indigenous perspective is totally what song lines are about, and I think that that's really interesting that right now Western science, you know, I think at the heart of it, it's really about how to care for country. The actual pragmatic, you know, Aboriginal people in traditional society, the average person knew intricate knowledge about 400 plants per person. So if you actually just stop to think about that, like when they flower, when they season, which parts of them are poison, which parts of them are potions, how to prepare the potions. I mean, you don't have a way of writing that down. And so, you know, that's epic in the idea of that, you know, within these stories is this, you know, incredible compendium of data. Scientific data, and the way that that was recorded and downloaded by Aboriginal people through story, and how the land itself became the visual indicator to remind you of that story, because you can imagine with Chinese whispers over 80,000 years, you know, those stories, it's incredible to me that they stayed so intact, because within those stories about those amazing flowers and things that, you know, the creatures would turn into and stuff like that, they're actually, you know, quite practical knowledge. If you look at something
sophisticated
knowledge, and if you look at something like climate change now, that you can't look at climate change from an Indigenous perspective without understanding, you know, how it relates to the stars, and how the way that the climate was mapped was to do with, you know, when the flowers are, you know, when the wattle is flowering, you know, the mullet is running, and there were all these connections between the animals and the way they were behaving, when to hunt them, when, you know, related to when flowers were planting, when the stars were at a certain position in the sky. And so that observation and repetition that happened, and, you know, that trial and error that happened over 80,000 years has us... There's so much we still have to glean from that before the keepers of that knowledge, you know, we lose the keys to unlock it.
Well, there's so much potential knowledge to be gained. Can you just briefly tell us the story of the Aboriginal man from Groote Eylandt in the Top End who has a neurodegenerative disease and he believes a cure can be found from the land and the salt water on his country. Just tell us briefly about that.
We're talking about Steve Buckler at Warramurra, who we made a short film earlier this year at his request. He really wanted, I suppose it was his way of adding to the songlines from his country. But he has Mercado-Joseph disease, which is a neurodegenerative disease where you basically become a prisoner in your own... Your mind is absolutely fine, but your body over time breaks down because of the proteins in the brain and the abnormalities there. Buckler has that. They believe that that family, that it came over with the Chinese, actually, that were trading with the communities, you know, hundreds of years ago, and, you know, you have a 50% chance of passing it on to your children. And it's really insidious in that it accelerates as it goes. So the symptoms come on quicker with each new generation. But they believe that an ancestor of theirs cut a dugong up the wrong way, and so that family has been cursed. And so Buckler wanted to tell that story. And even though he says to me, oh, I know there's no dugongs in China. so, you know, his rational mind is saying, you know, but it's so, you know, their knowledge is so narrative, you know, there isn't really any narrative fiction, you know, it's true. And so, you know, when he wanted to find a cure on country, he had a dream and this spirit came to him and told him to find the cure. The cure's in the salt water, the salt water country. And so he is working with the MJD Foundation now and actually collecting lots of different sort of traditional medicines from that land, which they have a book like this, is this thick of medicines, which none of us know, and science knows nothing about. You know, there's this huge, you know, library of knowledge.
Do you think that's changing? I mean, you're working at the moment on a project that you can't tell us about, so I won't ask you about it. But nonetheless, you're working on this program about Indigenous knowledge of science and technology that we may see in the future. Do you think we're at a moment now where there is increased interest in this stuff?
Well, I think it's some of that interest is sinister, in the sense that we do have Big Pharma here in, you know, setting up shop in remote parts of Australia, actually bioprospecting and looking for medicines. And so when you have a community, you know, like Buckler's that actually does the right thing and prints, you know, these books that, you know, try and keep their knowledge alive, that IP is sitting there waiting to be stolen. You know, it's be really interesting for most audience, the audience to know that, you know, when the Allied forces landed in Normandy on D-Day, they all had in their pocket a little bit of traditional knowledge from Australia. They all had a medicine called Travacarm, which is synthesised from the Australian corkwood tree, which wasn't even stolen just from Indigenous people. It was stolen from all Australians, you know, that knowledge. And so I think that there's that interest that's going on, which is an economic interest. But I do think that, you know, I hope that in, you know, 5-10 years' time, science and technology subjects at school, we are learning science from an Indigenous perspective because it is amazing. And we know, because we're exporting fire stick farming to Africa and Namibia and Argentina, there's a lot to offer.
I'd kind of like to connect this discussion we've been having about songlines and the exhibition here with the broader discussions about Indigenous issues within the community. We have not resolved our past in Australia. Indigenous people rightly feel that there is unfinished business that needs to be attended to. The Uluru Statement, I think, touches on some of the things that the Indigenous community would like to see to help us move forward as a nation. I think, as Scott was saying, among white fellas there can be a sense of guilt that causes inertia. There can be a sense of denial as well, that there is a stain on our history. How do the songlines fit within all of that? How relevant are they to our sense of our identity and our history, and can enhanced understanding of them help us to move forward? Is that too ambitious an aim, Margot, for partly what this exhibition is seeking to do?
No, it's all... What Songlines is doing is really just setting up an environment under which a lot of these things can find some, nourishment, attitudinal changes. For example, just like Amanda Vanstone came through the exhibition and came out all... Like you, under a hallucinatory experience. Anyway, no, not quite. And she said, she was basically saying, this is so powerfully positive, this is so inclusive, I've never felt so part of this history or this country before. And she was sort of, I'm physically transformed. She was, talking like this, and she had tears in her eyes. And it was this positive inclusiveness. So...
And she's not the only one, either.
No.
Others have...
This is a common story. Andrea Mason, the CEO of the MPY Women's Council, she talks about how if the heart of the nation's healthy, the rest of the nation will be healthy, and that sort of somehow resounds with the Songlines exhibition. But dozens of people come with that same story. I've never really got it. They're not sure what they get. They just get a connection they never had before, and that has to, have some attitudinal change. Now, it's a matter of getting all the decision makers and leaders and influential people in there as well. So I just think that, there's a too long story to go into now, but I think there's something powerful happening with the way the elders have worked on this that will transform into something that we can tap into.
Scott, I think we can all see the importance of preserving these stories for Indigenous communities who are custodians of them, but for the broader issue of reconciliation, for want of a better term, can these stories help us to move forward and increase knowledge of these stories?
I can only, Alison and Curtis and Margot, speak from my own experience of being invited in over 20 years, since working with Leah Purcell on Box the Pony, and then with Trevor on Career Highlights of the Mamu, and then Napaji Napaji, and with the Namajiras, and with Hip Bone Sticking Out. Many of these pieces have been here in Canberra, at the Canberra Theatre Centre. The one abiding theme, the two abiding themes, were that I was the learner who had some skills, and I was invited into a generous space in which I was protected. I was safe from knowledge that is powerful, and I think we need to start recognising that. And I was protected, and Curtis would understand this, by gentle deflection away from things that were not for my knowledge. To me, this is the future. It is about being prepared, who we are, who you are, Paul, and who most of the audience is, to... number one, assume you don't know. Number two, assume people will be generous with you. And yes, it's tricky here, because in Canberra you have one of the world's great embassies sitting right here. 2022, that's the anniversary. It hasn't been invited into the narrative yet. I hope it will be. It's vexed for Canberra because it sits there, and it's a reminder of the fear that we feel, that I feel, that I'm going to make a mistake, that, you won't be generous with me. But you've got to push through that fear.
You still fear that.
I feel that all the time, because the one guarantee is that I will make a mistake, not because I'm a fool, and not because this culture is more sacrosanct than mine. It's because I'm walking into a new place, and those two things work together: generosity and exchange, and Napaji Napaji, reciprocity. Those
responsibility.
Are the, yeah, that's exactly. They are the the words of this centre of our country and the words of the heritage that is offered to us all. And let me just say two other things.
Yeah.
Over 150 nations, for thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, on a continent like Europe, the world's greatest display of diplomacy, cultural diplomacy. What an asset. We never talk about it. Number two, and you alluded to it, incredible ecological stewardship for 2,000 generations. What an asset.
Mm.
You know, and what do? We are scared of it because we think we're going to get in trouble, so we ignore it. Now, answer me this. You know, if you saw the Namajira documentary, Lenny Kumajay Namajira just passed away 6 days after getting the copyright back. And, you know, it's tragic, but it is how it is. And do we honour the traditional owners? Do they, who have struggled, do they sit down the road here in Canberra in the War Memorial? Do they get their portraits painted by, which is the way that we in this culture bestow status and wealth?
Recognise.
Exactly. So, you know, it sits with us. It's a generous space. Let's move into it. Be willing to make mistakes.
Okay.
But we mustn't negate the gains and the advances that are made. You know, the Archibald, that Aboriginal works, the stuff's happening. I'm not denying anything you say,
no.
But we must, whilst we're looking at things that have been slow or things that are things that we have happened that are tragic, I think the work we all do here is very much about, and I was talking to Matt Trinker today about this, it's very much about all moving forward together in this sort of productive dialogue for a new future and a shared future.
I'm going to have to wrap this,
yep.
But I do want to give Curtis the last word. Curtis, I can see why it's important for your people to preserve this knowledge for the younger generations of Indigenous people. Do you care, though, about whether white fellas understand more about these stories as well? Is that part of your thinking as well?
I think the well-being of people, if you make them, if they make themselves better, they make the country better. And I think that's one of the most important things, that once, you know, this their well-being is looked after or getting better, then there's a much freer, healthier dialogue between different peoples and other peoples that not unwell will feed off that and feed off their country. And that's what a lot of the old people talk about, that, you know, you make the country better, you make the people better, and everything comes back stable to make it more healthy.
Fabulous discussion. Look, thanks very much to our four guests tonight. Look, thanks for coming along tonight. Thanks an enormous amount to the National Museum for inviting me to come along once again. It is always a pleasure and an honour to be here, and I tell you what, I always go away with so enlightened and with so much new information spinning around in my head. It's a bit like what you were saying earlier, Alison. I've got a sore head from all of this additional information. Thanks for coming along. Thanks to our guests. And Matt, do you want to say a few words to wrap up the conversation?
Just quickly, just again, thanks to our panellists tonight. What an inspiring discussion, ranging across not just this work that's here at the museum at the moment, but issues, I think, that go to the heart of meaning and our future in this country. So please join me again in thanking the panellists.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.